What we're going to talk about is what you and I can do to get patients back to where they want to be. And what I wanted to do during this presentation is I wanted to be very, very pragmatic and very conversational. I don't want to go through just one treatment after another, try this, try that, try this, try that. We'll get into some options clearly. But maybe what I will do is I will maybe step back a couple of steps and speak to some of the key therapeutic targets or key therapeutic objectives that people with depression are really asking for. I've been a psychiatrist now for over 2 decades, and that incredible privilege that I've been given to meet people, meet families, I've heard narrative after narrative after narrative that the treatments are not delivering what I'd hoped they could deliver. And this has made me think about this over the years, and it's encouraged not just to rethink, but it's also, I think, encouraged a refocus on what are the therapeutic objectives. And I'm going to be spending a lot of time on that just to kind of have more of a divergent process, and then we'll converge on some treatment options. This is, in fact, the learning objectives. Now, the learning objectives really are just very broad. We're going to speak to treatment-resistant depression broadly, but we're going to narrow it with respect to how do we define it, not only from your perspective and my perspective, but from the people who live with depression's perspective. And we will certainly spend a lot of time speaking about some potential treatment options. Okay, let's get started if we can. So I'm not going to really spend too much time on the phenomenology of major depression and really talk about academic points around its epidemiology. I like to refer to the 25-75 rule insofar as about 25% of adults with major depressive disorder represent about 75% of the costs of the disorder. So if we look at major depressive disorder, the best way to kind of conceptualize it is it's a group of disorders. It's a plural, major depressive disorders. And within that very, very heterogeneous group, there are subpopulations that respond immediately to the first antidepressant you prescribe. Others, in fact, get better spontaneously. Others, in fact, get better with the second treatment, and so on and so on and so on. But a sizable percentage, depends how we define it, which we're getting into in a moment, say 25% at least, represent what we call treatment-resistant depression. Now, over the next 20 minutes or so, I'm going to try to make the case that I think the percentage is much higher than that if we define treatment-resistant depression from the patient's perspective. I really like this survey that was conducted. This survey surveyed healthcare providers. It also surveyed people who have depression. And it asked a very simple question. What are your therapeutic objectives with antidepressant treatment? And what you can see from the response from the healthcare providers, there was a priority given to taking away symptoms, eliminating depression, eliminating the distress of depression in various ways that's articulated. On the right, which is the patient response, they want their symptoms improved. It's a little further down the list. What's higher on the list is positive mental health, to feel myself again, a sense of vitality, a sense of well-being. And this is part of a larger recognition that there's a bit of a disconnect between what the consumer is prioritizing and what we prioritize. I don't think we're completely on different pages, but we are not prioritizing this in a way that's entirely aligned. And this would, in many ways, be aligned with my own clinical experience, because I have noticed over the years, I do a PHQ-9, I do a QIDS SR-16 in my office, and the patient appears to be, if not in remission, the patient certainly is approaching remission. And I'll talk to the patient and I'll, you know, say, how are you feeling and so on. And it's not uncommon for the person to say, I don't feel well. I don't feel myself. And then they have that form in their hand, the disability form, and they say, oh, can you fill this out for me? I still can't go back to work. And this is not an uncommon occurrence. So let's, in fact, if we can, speak to a definition. So there's over a dozen definitions of what is treatment-resistant depression. The FDA, as well as the European FDA, called the EMA, they have a definition which is captured on this slide. And that is an individual with major depressive disorder who has received 2 sequential, mechanistically different antidepressants. And despite two sequential, adequate dose, adequate duration trials from antidepressants from different classes, the person still is highly symptomatic or clinically symptomatic and has not achieved the goals that they would like. Now, when it comes to the definition of response or remission, you've all heard about this over the years. If in fact we're going to say that the person has not achieved the therapeutic objectives with first two treatments, then what are the therapeutic objectives? And when I started, it was always about response, just try to get symptoms somewhat better. Then we refined it further, we evolved further, we said, let's get patient symptoms into full remission, the full abatement of symptoms. And that has been the therapeutic target for quite some time. When we look at STAR-D, a study we've all seen many, many, many times, this is a recognition in many ways of a couple of things. First of all, how common it is to encounter people who don't benefit sufficiently with treatment one, treatment two. But I've often referred to this slide as the window of opportunity slide, insofar as you can just see visually what happens after those first two treatments are unsuccessful. The third one, it really drops off. And I bring that up because I've met colleagues all across the lower 48, many, many times, all around the world. And one of the themes that I've heard over my career is people will say to me, you know, I save the big gun treatments until everything else doesn't work. And I'll say to them sometimes, why don't you try this treatment? It works really, really well. Yeah, I like that one too, but I want to wait till the other ones don't work. Now, part of this is formularies and the healthcare system and fail first and all this type of frustration. But in my view, this speaks loudly for us really to get the right treatments out of the gate as soon as possible. Now, this slide in some ways speaks to a similar concept that I started off with, that there's a bit of a disconnect between what healthcare providers prioritize and what the person who lives with depression prioritizes. What this slide is saying is that amongst people who are in remission, they're in remission according to the Hamilton Depression Rating Scale, that is the score of 7 or less, half of them still say they don't feel well. And I've always been curious about this. Is that because they are setting goals that are too aspirational? Have I been unclear in terms of what those goals should be? But I've wondered about this over the years, and it's taken us in a direction towards cognition and reward, which I'm going to come back to in a moment. Now, this is a snapshot of the performance of antidepressants in the aggregate over the past 40 years, in blue. It's also a snapshot of how placebo is performing over the last 40 to 50 years. Those with a really good eye will notice that placebo is working better and better. If you're into the markets and the stock market, you should invest in placebo. That's my takeaway. But what I would also say is something's going on here. Just as a kind of parenthetical note, back in the day in the 60s and 70s, new antidepressants were typically developed on inpatient units. By definition, severe depression, melancholic depression. Over the last 20, 30 years, clinical trials in depression have gotten a bit more, I would say, democratic, in the sense that they are in outpatients, ambulatory patients, often done in patients not as severely ill. And the drug placebo difference in aggregate is not as robust in mild depression as it is in severe depression. Now, cynically, someone could say, we haven't made any advances in 40 years in antidepressants. That's not my interpretation of that slide. We sure have. Agents are better in terms of safety and overdose and tolerability overall. And when you start to look at this in a granular way, there are advantages. Some patients do better on one antidepressant, for example, if they have pain. We think about an SNRI. Cognition, we've seen some data for 4-deoxetine. Seasonal depression and smoking cessation, bupropion. Comorbidities like the anxiety disorders, the SSRIs, and so on and so on. But it is absolutely true that most people are not achieving the goals they want. And this is part of a larger, I think, transformation happening in medicine broadly, where there's really a pivot towards not just patient-centric outcomes, but outcomes that are not only aiming to taketh away, but to giveth. The taketh away of mental illness doesn't giveth you health. And my own observations over the last almost 2 years with this terrible pandemic, probably no different than your observations. You're seeing, in fact, people on evening news programs and so on speaking about the want to define their life differently. And my sense is it's part of a larger international conversation about vitality, fulfillment, and to flourish. And you all know that about 9 months ago, the New York Times made the word languishing the word of COVID-19. I think a lot of us can relate to what that feels like. Now, moments ago, I showed you the very often showed slide from STAR-D. This was the decreasing probability of success with each antidepressant strategy. The message is get the patients diagnosed, get these patients on guideline concordant care as soon as possible. This is now quality of life. So when you look at STAR-D across these sequential quality of life measures, you see, in fact, that only about a quarter of people on a good day are really achieving quality of life after 4 treatments, but even after that first treatment, in remission, a long way to go. So we have people in our office. They have major depressive disorder. We've made the diagnosis accurately and timely. The patient has been prescribed at least 2 antidepressants. And either according to a clinical outcome assessment from your perspective or the patient's perspective, like the PHQ-9, the patient is still not doing well. And or the symptoms seem to be largely in remission, but the patient's saying, I just don't feel myself. I can't function. I don't feel any kind of engagement with my family, my friends. I can't work. This person clearly is not well. So guiding principles, let's make sure we've identified comorbidities that could get in the way. Of course, we always think about this, but this is a very basic starting point, which we can't forget. One point I always like to come back to, make sure the diagnosis is correct. Make sure the patient has major depression and it's not some other diagnosis like bipolar disorder. And this is a screening tool for bipolar disorder called the Rapid Mood Screener, which we validated with some colleagues here in America. We've had screening tools for bipolar for over 2 decades that can be self-administered. And the guiding principle of screening for anything, including bipolar disorder, is you want a screening tool that is brief, patient-administered, you want good sensitivity, and you also want what we call good negative predictive value. And what good negative predictive value means is that if the person screens negative, you got a high level of confidence they don't have it. So it's got to be brief, patient-administered, good sensitivity, and good negative predictive value. And if they screen positive, that doesn't mean they have bipolar. That means you got to roll your sleeves up and take a very detailed history. But one of the pushbacks I've heard over 20 years in the area of bipolar disorder is that there's too many false positives. There's too many people with a diagnosis like borderline personality disorder or ADHD or drug and alcohol misuse or some other diagnosis that screen positive for bipolar disorder. And that's why we decided to create a new scale. We engineered it to have fewer items and also items that really speak to the validity of the diagnosis, like the age at onset, the number of depressions, and also reaction to previous antidepressants. And we hope this is going to reduce some of the false positives that we have seen with many of the screening tools for bipolar disorder. That's free of charge. You can certainly access that free from Google. Now, when I sit with a patient and we're talking about the next step treatment strategy, like you all, I'm taking a detailed personal and family history. And we know from the literature, and we know from our experience, that between 30 to as high as 75% of people with major depression report trauma as an adult and or as a child. What this slide is telling you is that if you have a history of childhood trauma, physical or sexual abuse or emotional abuse, that cuts the response and remission rate in half with SSRIs. With SSRIs. And I'm being very careful to emphasize with SSRIs. Now, my own experience would entirely align with this because I have also noticed this, that patients with a history of trauma, recently or in the past or both, don't have the same predictability of response or remission to SSRIs. Maybe that's not the case for some other medicines. And this gets me thinking out loud. maybe there's something about trauma that's changing the phenotype. Maybe it's changing the biology of that depression. Let me give you an example. We know people with depression who have a history of trauma are more likely to have cognitive impairment. They're more likely to be anhedonic. They often say, I feel detached, I feel nothing. They feel disengaged. When we look beneath the hood, we take some blood, they're more likely to have an inflammatory biotype. And that's interesting to us, because maybe there's something different about this depression. That's not just an academic point. Maybe that guides what we do next. Maybe that guides the next step treatments. Now, a few moments ago, I said, let's rule out comorbidities. And everyone agrees with that. One other aspect I have been trying to emphasize over the years, you probably heard me say this at NEI before, is this phrase that I coined a number of years ago, that obesity metastasizes to the brain. And I say that purposefully because most of my patients are overweight or obese, especially abdominal obesity. And we know that when you're overweight or obese, that increases the likelihood of a change in your biology. And more specifically, you start to exhibit an increased rate of inflammatory markers in your blood. When we look at cognitive measures or measures of anhedonia in depressed people who have overweight obesity, it's more impaired. And these are studies that have been done in bariatric surgery patients showing that weight loss, significant weight loss, is pro-cognitive. It improves cognitive functions. It improves hedonistic functions. So when I'm treating the depressed patient who has treatment-resistant depression, I'm not just thinking about what I can do above the neck, I'm thinking about what I can do below the neck to help that affected person. Every treatment guideline that I've ever encountered in the last 5 years has really pressed the point around 2 to 4 weeks. 2 to 4 weeks, what's that mean? And this is in the Florida Medicaid guidelines, which are the most updated guidelines here in America, circa 2020. If you start an antidepressant and the patient after 2 to 4 weeks is not showing some degree of benefit, you've got to turn the dose up. And for those maybe who are less familiar, maybe some younger people here, in the old days, like 10 years ago, 6 years ago, we were told to wait 6 to 8 weeks. Now it's 2 to 4 weeks. You increase the dose. I'm not saying change the medication if they're tolerating it. I'm saying increase the dose. So we don't need to wait 6 to 8 weeks to dial up the dose. That's an important point. The other important point to emphasize is that not all symptoms of depression are created equal. Now, in the DSM-5, we have that criteria list for a depression. You all know it. You have to have 5 of 9 symptoms. And if you think about it for a moment, if you have to have 5 of 9 symptoms, it doesn't matter which symptoms you have, as long as you have 5 of 9, that implies all the symptoms are kind of the same. They're all equally weighted to get a diagnosis in the chart of depression. But every single study that's been done looking at the symptoms of depression and its relationship to health outcomes has shown the symptoms are not equal. In some symptoms, disproportionately account for impaired function at home and outside the home, decreased quality of life, and decreased satisfaction with treatment. And those symptoms relate to cognition, I can't focus, I can't think, can't pay attention, and reward. Now, my patients don't come in my office and say, Dr. McIntyre, I have a problem with reward. They don't say that. They come in the office and they say, I'm tired, I'm fatigued, I can't get off the couch, I have no motivation, I'm pretty convinced I got chronic fatigue syndrome. I hear this all day, so do you. What they're saying to you is, I got a reward problem. Because anhedonia is not just the absence of pleasure, it's the absence of anticipating pleasure. It's also a problem with reward learning, learning positive experiences. And so the patient who's fatigued doesn't lack mitochondria, they don't lack sugar, they have a problem with reward tone. And this is how it comes across. Then what happens is the patient says to me, Dr. McIntyre, you know, I don't know what it is, but these medications, I can't laugh, I can't cry on these medications. They're turning me into a zombie. That's emotional blunting. And emotional blunting is a constriction of the repertoire of your affect. You're kind of just straitjacketed. You've all seen this. Half of patients with SSRIs report this. This is a little bit different than anhedonia, which is the absence of anticipating pleasure and the absence of experiencing pleasure. But again, the person who says to you, I'm tired, has a problem with anticipating pleasure. The person who says, my favorite movie, my favorite meal is bland, that's a problem with experiencing pleasure. And these are common complaints that we see in our patients. So I asked the question, should we just pay our patients to take their medications? Cross my mind. You're probably thinking, is this guy smoking crack? No, it crossed my mind. Now let me in fact just say a bit more about this. We know that education is not enough to change human behavior. That's why education is part of a larger adult behavioral change program. This was a really cool study. This study, I think, is so cool. What these folks did is they took adults with depression and they broke them into three groups. One got the usual care, and on this slide, it's called control group. And the other two groups got paid. We're going to pay you to take your antidepressants. And group one is the escalating group. They got $2 a day for week one, $3 a day for week two, $4, $5, $6, $8, so on. That's the escalating group. The other group got $8 on day one for that first week, $7, $6, $5, $4. That's the de-escalation group. Okay, the people who got paid took their antidepressants at a much greater frequency than those who didn't. And by the way, for those who are maybe less familiar, this has been shown in a lot of areas of chronic disease. Just pay people. Now, I'm not arguing to pay them. That's not my point. My argument is, what's going on here? And what's going on here is, isn't it interesting that people who get paid more as you get to the finish line do better than those that got paid a lot out of the gate and you're de-escalating thereafter? This speaks to what you and I see all the time. How often do your patients stop taking medications after 3 to 4 weeks? 50% of the time. Partly because they say they feel better, but also because they don't have what we call affective forecasting. You watch the weather person give you the evening weather report to give you what's coming over the next 7 days. There's an implicit calculation always going on that we're always doing. We're always trying to forecast the future. We're always anticipating. It's a silent calculation. The person doesn't do this mathematically in their head and explicitly. And when people leave our office with a prescription, they actually have to have an intact reward system that's saying to them implicitly, just stay with the game plan. You're going to get side effects. You're not going to feel well for a while, but 8 weeks out you will, or 6 weeks out you will. And that speaks to something we often see. This is why it's so important to be thinking about blunting and thinking about these reward problems in these patients. By the way, this is also why it's really important to have repeat visits or nowadays with technology, firing out some type of patient support through a text or something to get them through this period, to try to get them out of this vicious cycle towards a more virtuous cycle. This actually supports a comment I had earlier that about half of people who take SSRIs are blunted. And this gets kind of mixed in with anhedonia. Again, anhedonia, no pleasure, experience, or anticipation. Blunting is more this constriction. Let's say a few words about COVID. Now, I said about 5 or 10 minutes ago that if you have depression and you have a history of childhood trauma, you have an attenuated response to SSRIs. I also commented in passing that trauma, especially in childhood, but trauma increases the likelihood of cognitive impairment and reward problems like anhedonia in those persons. I would argue that COVID-19's been a trauma. No argument, not a difficult argument to make. And it's a different type of trauma. I mean, there's been obvious trauma. There's been bereavement and loss, and terrible things have happened to humanity. But people have had to live for a year and a half, 2 years now, with not just chronic stress, but chronic unpredictable stress. When the hell is this going to end? And chronic unpredictable stress in the lab is called cuss. And I think cuss makes me want to cuss. Because when you have chronic stress and you know when it's going to end, that's a very different ballgame than chronic unpredictable stress. This has been shown in stress research. And it certainly begs the question whether you and I as mental health care advocates and professionals are more likely to see treatment-resistant depression during COVID. It's a testable hypothesis, I don't know. But for many people, because of insecurity of housing and food and finance and job and healthcare, this has been an immeasurable stress for so many people. We've heard just the terrible statistics in toll this has taken. But certainly my own impression clinically, I'm seeing more people who are not just languishing, but are anhedonic, are cognitively impaired, and are coming in saying, I need something else to help me. Now, the first dictum of medicine is to do no harm. And we want to, first of all, make sure the diagnosis is accurate. We want to make sure that we've ruled out comorbidities that are contributory. What about our pills? Benzodiazepines, first identified in 1955. The first one was chlordiazepoxide, not one we prescribe much anymore. Benzos are still passed out. And Steve and I often joke that the benzos are the pornography of medicine. No one wants to admit they watch it, but somebody is. And no one wants to admit they prescribe benzos, but somebody is. They're very popular. And benzos have a very important therapeutic utility in depression. The next statement is they often contribute to cognitive impairment, which you all know. And they also worsen anhedonia, that sense of blah. They make it worse. This slide is unrelated to my comments. This is a slide I wanted to put in the program today. I did this twice. I was always curious about this. Biases. Biases in how we prescribe our medicines. This was a study I did with my colleagues in Taiwan. We had some replication in Florida, similar concept. We found that male prescribers are more likely to prescribe benzos to female patients than our female prescribers. Male prescribers are more likely to prescribe benzos to females than our female prescribers. That's a longer conversation, but I thought that was interesting. And it's another thing to be thinking about in this world that we're in now, this changing world. Tremendous sensitivities to aspects of equality and diversity and inclusion. And being aware, try to make yourself aware of some of these forces that are changing our behavior, shaping our behavior. What is this slide telling us? This slide's telling us if a patient comes in your office and he or she has a lot of anhedonia, they're less likely going to respond to an SSRI. I find that to be a rather unfortunate situation because anhedonia is like a cornerstone of depression. The more you have of it, less likely SSRIs work. Remember I said that about two-thirds of the impairment in depression is because of cognition and reward. Now, that's not the whole story. Sleep contributes. Other aspects contribute. But what's occurring in the field as we try to be more what's called mediational, which I prefer the word fractionation. You see, when I look at a cholesterol panel, it's fractionated. We got total cholesterol and all the LDL, HDL triglycerides. That's the way you and I need to think about depressive symptoms. The total score matters. And then the next point is the subscores also matter. What's the fraction? How's your cognition? How's your reward? Because when you look at people who ultimately do better on your antidepressant, the aspects that are improving most is measures of anhedonia, as well as measures of cognition. This was an analysis we did with colleagues at Cleveland Clinic, and we found that in depression, how severely depressed you are doesn't seem to really contribute, at least in an explanatory way, to whether you're going to work and performing at work. What's more relevant is how cognitively impaired you are. And so where I'm going with this is, I call this the cholesterol slide. LDL cholesterol probably tells you more than total cholesterol, if you will, for cardiovascular outcomes. I'm overstating it, simplifying it, but that's what I want to try to get at here. One of your MCQs was around side effects. I think most of you got it right. Atypical antipsychotics, we have brexpiprazole, aripiprazole, quetiapine, we have olanzapine, fluoxetine. These are the most studied with respect to treatment of next choice, FDA approved. You guys all know the pushback has been for some of these treatments, some of the side effect concerns. Now, a lot of this is modifiable, and a lot of this is different across different agents, and I think we all have our experience with different agents, and we know the benefits. What I like about atypicals is they're FDA approved, and they are effective. I also like the fact that they really target some of the common residual symptoms that I encounter, like anxiety, agitation, as well as rumination. See lots of patients who come to the clinic and they say, Dr. McIntyre, I got obsessive compulsive disorder. And I ask them, do you wash your hands, you check, you count, you order, you have symmetry? No. So when you say you have OCD, what does that mean? Oh, I'm always thinking about something. I can't get it out of my head. It's like a reel. It's like this reel in my head. Well, that's rumination, that purposeless, negative, very anxiety-causing, depression-causing phenomenology, so common in depression, responds beautifully to atypicals. But of course, we need to make sure we balance the benefits with the risks, and I'm aware from the MCQ response, everyone's very clear about that. And that's obviously one of the liabilities. Now, where do we go next? We have the treatment of next choice of the atypicals, brexpiprazole, aripiprazole, quetiapine. I don't prescribe much olanzapine fluoxetine combination because of the weight gain. And here's just a sampling of some of the newer targets, or at least targets that the street light is shining on now, because they're not really new. They're new all over again, so to speak. Let's say a couple of words about ketamine. So here in the United States and Canada, over 40 countries around the world, esketamine has been approved for adults who have treatment-resistant depression. In the case of esketamine, also approved in depression with suicidality. IV ketamine, esketamine, intranasal are the two most well-studied formulations and delivery methods in this population. Ketamine's target, you know, it's glutamate, the NMDA system. It involves other systems as well. And the advantage of this medicine is that it has been able to offer symptom relief within a very short period of time. In the case of esketamine, we're going to talk about this, 24 hours, or probably even sooner. This is just a dashboard, just to give you a sense of many other glutamate drugs that are being looked at in the area of depression. I'm going to pick a few of them just to focus on, but you can see this has really just taken off. Recently, in May of this year, we published an international consensus statement and guideline on how to implement ketamine and esketamine in the American Journal of Psychiatry. And the impetus for me to really put this all together was I had been at many clinics around America. We needed guardrails. Who's the right patient? What kind of personnel? What kind of setting? What kind of monitoring is required? What kind of dosing? Key questions. This is, in fact, something that's been summarized in this particular document. Now, the question I'm asked all the time is, can I give ketamine orally or topically? How about through lozenges, sublingually? And the answer is you can do anything you want in life, I suppose. But the evidence would support intranasal spray Spravato, intravenous racemic. There are data accumulating for oral, but it's not quite at the same level of quantity and quality as intranasal and intravenous. This is an area that's growing very, very quickly and moving very, very quickly. And the data are unequivocal that both treatments, IV racemic and intranasal Spravato, added to an antidepressant, get people better within 24 hours. In fact, even sooner, IV ketamine within about 4 hours. You've also heard that ketamine and esketamine have had the ability to benefit aspects of suicidality. Now, this has been looked at with both IV racemic and the intranasal S, and I'll just keep it brief by saying this is obviously important. It's an extremely important outcome, but what we still don't know is whether these two formulations and routes of delivery actually reduce suicide. You see, clozapine and lithium seem to increase suicide, especially lithium, probably also clozapine. But we don't know this yet for ketamine and esketamine. The million-dollar question in my mind now is how can we keep patients well who took this treatment? Most go for repeat dosing. But there are other strategies, not just pharmacologic, but psychosocial. This is a study which has now been updated this year, showing that cognitive behavioral therapy can be implemented after a trial of ketamine IV to keep patients well longer. That fits with the conceptual framework that ketamine is facilitating neurogenesis and plasticity, almost like preparing the brain, so to speak, for psychotherapy. This is an interesting concept. This is an area that's under active study. The other question I've been asking myself is, if I see a patient who's failed two antidepressants, should I give them Spravato or should I give them IV ketamine? That's still a question to be addressed. We don't have good comparator studies. Well, what about the related question? Should I give them an atypical antipsychotic or should I give them ketamine or esketamine? What about the other question? Should they get ECT or TMS or an atypical or esketamine, ketamine? So you and I now, when a patient finishes two treatments, you saw the STAR-D result, we in fact have neurostimulation, we've got glutamate, and we have atypicals, and we don't have good evidence to guide us as to which one's the best one to pick, at least based on good head-to-head studies. Spravato was developed in MDD, TRD, as well as suicidality, co-initiated with an antidepressant, works in 24 hours. And I know this is an expensive treatment, access has been an issue, and that's another story that goes beyond the science of this, but these are obviously important data. It's been updated now to not only include relapse prevention, but also in MDD with suicidality. With respect to other modalities, we're now moving into more investigational areas. We now know that 35 to 45% of people with depression, especially treatment-resistant depression, have elevated CRPs, elevated inflammation. There are data, this is one of the questions, showing that NSAIDs, omega-3s, statins, minocycline, the antibiotic, are antidepressant in clinical trials where they've been added. Should we all be going to our office tomorrow and prescribing NSAIDs, omega-3s, statins, and minocycline? I would say hold your horses, hold your horses. There are limitations to this. It works, but the studies are small. A lot of heterogeneity in the studies. More work is needed. Last week in Lancet Global, there was a replication of this study that appeared over a year ago. You probably all heard about this study. This is fluvoxamine to treat people who are infected with COVID. Not to treat depression, but to prevent decompensation of COVID symptoms. They're infected, they're in hospital, giving them fluvoxamine or placebo to prevent decompensation, and it worked better than placebo. This has now been replicated in a large Brazilian study last week. Big study, 1,500 patients. What the heck's going on here? This speaks to the immune modulating effects of our conventional drugs. This is perhaps through what's called the sigma-1 receptor. Fluoxetine also does the same thing. Many drugs actually affect the sigma-1 receptor. But my point is not to give out SSRIs to treat COVID. My point is that this speaks to something we've known for decades, that our drugs, our conventional drugs, also affect the immune system. Minocycline has shown efficacy in pivotal trials or small proof of concept trials in meta-analysis, but I don't think it's still ready for the prime time. I've done some of this work at our lab because we don't have the large trials yet. But I thought you'd find it interesting that this anti-inflammatory drug that stabilizes the microglia has this effect. You've all heard of Balsamra, Lamborexant, Suvorexant, Celtorexant. These are these orexin receptor antagonist drugs for sleep. And they reduce overarousal, help sleep, very different MOA mechanism action. When I first heard about this physiology quite some time ago, I thought, wow, that's really interesting because it's at an intersection, not just of arousal and sleep, but also reward and cognition. Begs the question whether these drugs could potentially be antidepressant. We come to meetings like this to walk away with a few tips, also to kind of see where the puck is going. Sorry for the hockey analogy, I'm Canadian, I'm allowed. Where's the puck going? And this is in fact one of many studies that are underway looking at dual orexin receptor antagonists or single selective orexin receptor antagonists as possible antidepressants. So many of you are prescribing these drugs as a sleeping aid, but these drugs are under development, and it's going to be very interesting to see where this goes. We spoke this morning a little bit about psilocybin. Psilocybin is not ready for the prime time, but there are some preliminary data showing that it's helping patients with depression. There's some preliminary data on this. Integrate it with psychotherapy. And this is an area that's receiving a lot of attention these days. A lot of my patients are saying, hey, Dr. McIntyre, where can I get some shrooms? Where can I get some LSD? Where can I get some ayahuasca and DMT and mescaline? I say, I don't recommend this. It's illegal. We don't know. Lots of work. It needs to be done. And so I just want you all to know this is an investigational area, but it's not yet ready for prime time. One of the questions was around dextromethorphan bupropion. Interesting combination. Being developed for major depressive disorder. People are some maybe wondering, where the heck did this come from? Well, bupropion we know, of course. Dextromethorphan has effects on the glutamate system, NMDA. To a lesser extent, at low doses, opioid, but at the higher doses, opioid systems. And also sigma systems and catecholamine systems. And when you combine it together, you get a pharmacokinetic synergy and a pharmacodynamic synergy. It prolongs the bioavailability. Methadone. I wouldn't prescribe methadone for depression. But what about dextromethadone? Dextromethadone is being developed. Where did that come from? Well, because it's an NMDA drug. And that's an area people are looking at. I thought you'd find interesting also a treatment being developed for depression. Last few moments, neurostimulation. ECT, in my view, is still the heavyweight champion of the world when it comes to treating the most malignant, difficult to treat depressions. TMS is much more scalable, accessible, and it also works in treatment-resistant depression and should be considered after two treatment failures, along with an atypical, along with glutamate drugs. That's what we should be thinking about, what's available, what's the patient preference, this type of thing that enters the equation. What about psychotherapy? Psychotherapy is especially effective for some symptoms, but not others. And this analysis is not addressing the question, which one's more effective, antidepressant medicines or psychotherapy. What this slide is asking is a more, I think, clinically relevant question. Which symptoms do best with which intervention? It turns out antidepressants do better for fatigue, psychic anxiety, suicidality, cognitive symptoms, reward symptoms. So you integrate it. You integrate it with, in fact, psychotherapy. We have a loneliness pandemic. Many of you might remember the band Roxy Music. Remember Roxy Music? Brian Ferry? Loneliness is a very, very crowded room. That's what he said. We discovered that loneliness in patients increases the likelihood they're going to take antidepressants. Does it cause depression? It's contributory. And so over the years, I've in fact paid more attention to this. Yes, integrate pharmacotherapy, integrate psychotherapy. But if our patients are at home lonely, your treatments are not going to really work. And this is a very scalable, low-tech, low-cost intervention in Texas. People on Meals on Wheels, they were reached out. This was an interesting intervention. They just reached out, kind of an empathy connection, just to touch base with these people at home who are lonely. And they measured their loneliness with the UCLA 3-item loneliness scale. And they got less lonely just by having a reach out, less depressed, less anxious. That's a larger symposium for another day. But what I'm saying is we treat people in the larger interpersonal context. And this is something I pay much more attention to. A lot of your patients will say, I want no more medications. They don't work. I'm cleaning my body out of the medications. I just want talk therapy. I would say, don't do that. Because we don't have any evidence that psychotherapy works on its own for treatment-resistant depression. But we have lots of evidence it works when you add it to the antidepressants. And that's a really important teaching point for a lot of our patients who've gotten fed up, understandably, with one failure after the other. And that's, I think, a good way to be conceptualizing this as we go forward. Okay, so when it comes to treatment-resistant depression, we know it's common. I think the percentage of people who have this is a lot greater than we originally thought if we take a patient perspective to this condition. I really want to emphasize, take that dimensional approach, rule out bipolar disorder, and I've tried to leave you with a couple of strategies and ways to think about next step treatments in these folks.